photography, and show tunes. Subscribe! Well, it's, I mean, why not? Because it is Tuesday after all.
Yep.
So we got that going. Wait, wasn't 279 last week? No, I guess it wasn't.
I guess not.
Man, I'm all screwed up. Anytime we do it on a different day, it messes me up.
For weeks.
Yeah.
It's like jet lag.
Right. That's the only marker for time that I have is Tuesday. That sets me up for the rest of the week.
If we
do it on Monday,
yeah,
I'm screwed up.
I do believe that you said next week's going to be 279. I think you said that at the beginning of last week's show.
All yeah, right, so then, maybe then in this your head. Week is 279, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So it's Tuesday, the 29th of August. Wait, so 30 days, has September. So two more days.
Two and
more
then
days. It's September.
Yeah. I'm going to the U.S.
Czech Republic.
Open. Oh, U.S. Open. On
that was going to be my second choice.
Which I haven't been to in 10 years or so. And I keep meaning to go, and then I never end up getting tickets because A, it's expensive, and B, you know, just it gets by me. And then someone gave us tickets, nice box seats. So we're going to see U.S. Open. It'll be fun. You ever go see tennis live?
No. No.
He's like, I don't see tennis live. I see Rush live.
Yeah. No, I mean, the last time I got into watching tennis was you know, the Connors McEnroe fiasco.
That was a while ago.
It's been a while.
When you were in your 40s, right?
Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I had just retired and those two kids were going at it.
I told you the Connors story that I had one time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did I tell you that one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I like Jimmy Connors. Seems like a good guy.
He does seem like a good guy.
Yeah. So it is Tuesday. It is on taking pictures.
you had to figure that
obviously.
One out.
Obviously. Because we're talking about tennis. So
apparently Jeffrey and I are punchy.
You know you're in the right place. Bill Wadman in Brooklyn. Jeffrey Sidoris back in Silver Spring. After our trip away.
Whirlwind trip to the New England.
New England. First time to go to Maine anyway. I've been to New Hampshire, but it was funny. We released the book, right? We soft launched the book, which is now available. So photographybytheletter.com. Thank you to those of you who have purchased the book. It was kind of surreal getting the notifications pop up while we were on vacation of all the sales. Like,
nice.
You know, every time one would come in, you know, ding, ding. So thank you. Those of you who have purchased the book, I appreciate every single one of them. And we're probably going to release an update, fix a couple things, change a couple things. So you'll get an email notification.
Wait, what'd you miss? What, typos?
Just a couple little things that got through the cracks. So, you know, it's one of the cool things about the way we've distributed it you'll get a download link and it'll reset your download count, and the expiration. So you can just go re-download the new version and you'll be good to go.
Oh, neat. Okay.
But absolutely humbling. Thank you. The response has been terrific. Thank you. Anyway, so we released the thing, and then Tuesday morning, it's like 5 a.m, we're leaving for the airport. Still dark outside.
Right.
And we get a notification, simultaneous notifications on our phones that our flight has been delayed.
Womp womp.
Yeah, hadn't even made it to the Beltway yet, right? And then, like 2 minutes later, another notification: your flight has been canceled.
Oh,
yeah.
Due
so,
to what?
Apparently, and this is according to one of the customer service reps, somebody called in a bomb threat to BWI.
And so lots of flights were canceled. It wasn't
No, not just ours. They shut down the terminal. Apparently.
Okay.
But Southwest, they got us on a later flight later in the day, and they were terrific. We have had, between the two of us, I don't think we've ever had a bad experience on Southwest. I've heard people having bad experiences, but they've always been very good and very accommodating to us. And so
I was going to say, I think that that's minority opinion of Southwest in general.
I've heard that, but again, my experience has been terrific with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we went to Maine, and man, is it beautiful up there.
Yep.
It is gorgeous. So we flew into Manchester and spent some time with the family, and then rented a car and drove to Portland from there, and went the back way up, which tacked on like another, I don't know, hour or something. But we got to see all these little towns and these just fantastic landscape.
That, you went up like 202? Could be.
Gosh, I don't know. 202, 203, whatever it took.
Did you see any moose? Did you mooses no, go past?
No, okay. The only moose I saw was the steel one in the Manchester airport. I looked and I didn't see any moose.
They're fairly rare.
Yeah.
These are not common things here.
From the way you hear people talk, they're walking through the streets.
Well, they're enormous and they're scary. They can be mean.
I don't want to run in with a mean
moose. Right.
So, but terrific trip. A lot of fun. Lighthouses, beautiful. Coastline, beautiful.
Did you get up to Freeport and go to L.L. Bean's?
No, we did not. Okay. We only had a couple days in Portland. And so we walked around a lot. We tried a bunch of different restaurants.
Sure.
Had some terrific food and had some not so terrific food.
Could have gone into an ex-girlfriend of mine's store on Congress Street.
What's her store called?
Circa Home and something or other. It's houseware kind of thing, like oldie timey kind of stuff.
Huh. Because we were on Congress Street. Maybe we did go into it. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway.
A couple terrific like vintage and thrift stores up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of fun. But a couple experiences had me thinking about this. I've got a note in here, losing art and craft progress. And it,
progress. It was
what good ever came out of progress? And it got me thinking about it. So a couple little places in New Hampshire, in Milford, New Hampshire. We went to get ice cream at this local dairy. Okay, and it's called the Connolly Brothers Dairy Farm. Connolly Brothers Dairy. Connolly Brothers something. Anyway, Connolly Brothers. They've got a store. It's a working dairy, and they've got a store attached to it. And the store is all by honor system. There's nobody there. They've got, you know, you can buy milk and you know, beef products or ice cream that's all made on premises, and everything's priced, and you just leave however much money your total comes to.
Right.
And they've, you know, they've got a little calculator there for tax and all that, but there's nobody there, which I found fascinating in, you know, sort of modern America.
Welcome to New England.
Yeah, that there is an honor system. And apparently it's been this way for years.
Sure.
And the ice cream was fantastic, by the way. And then attached to it is one of the barns. And I walked in and there were probably, I don't know, 50 cows in there, maybe. Right. And, you know, I've seen cows from, you know, in fields. And I've, you know, I've not unfamiliar to me, but I'd never been that close to that many. And there were a couple guys in there, and I don't remember what I said. Commented that this is, you know, the closest I've ever been to so many cows. And the one guy said, "Do you want to feed one?"
You and said, "Yes, please."
I said, "Really?"
And you started unbuttoning your shirt.
Right. You could pretty much milk anything with nipples.
Yeah.
Can you milk a cat, Greg?
So he hands you a bottle.
So he hands me this big bottle of milk, and there's a little calf there, a month old calf named Wayne, and I got to feed Wayne, and there was, I don't even know how to describe the experience. I was talking to John about this. I don't even know how to describe it, but it felt like the right thing to do. Like it felt like this is part of a life cycle that I am. Separate from, but it feels like what we should be doing. the circle of life. Kind of, right?
Okay.
And it was kind of amazing, you know. So I'm feeding this bottle of milk to Wayne, and you know, he finishes the bottle and he kind of nuzzles up against me, and that was part one. And then part two later in the was it the same day? I think it was the next day. We went to a little place called Nelson's Candy Shop, and this is I think it is also in Wilton. Nelson's Candies, Wilton. Yeah, 65 Main Street. Little neighborhood candy shop. And I had known about Nelson's beforehand because they make these incredible candy canes every year for Christmas time. And I guess they're world famous. And the way they make them, they use, you know, it's peppermint, yes, but they also sort of... people have butter on their hands, like with the gloves, and sure. they finish it with, so it's got almost this butter rum kind of glaze over it with, and it's a very strange taste. It's a subtle flavor. It's not nearly as overtly peppermint as what we're used to.
Okay.
So it does take some getting used to, but I digress. So behind the counter, older gentleman making, pecan turtles. Okay, I mean, like with the pecans sure. and the caramel and the chocolate. And me being me, we got to talking. And it turns out that this was Doug Nelson, whose grandfather started this company, this candy shop in 1914.
Okay.
And he proceeds to give me a somewhat truncated, I'm sure, version of the history of their family, how his grandfather started it. And I'm, you know, asking questions all along the way. They, you know, had to close down at the Depression, but then opened again in, I think he said 1935. But you know, he invited me behind the counter and he was showing me how things were made and the machinery. His taffy puller, Bill, for example, is from 1903.
Nice.
And still running, he said, runs like a top. He's like, this yes. thing would split a 2x4 in half.
Yeah. Still pulls like a champ.
Yeah. The wrapping machine, they still use wax paper to wrap their individual taffies, which if you are a fan of saltwater taffy, which I am, best saltwater taffy I've ever had in my life. Particularly the anise flavor, the licorice is fantastic. Anyway, the wrapping machine, 1906.
Right.
You know, the big copper bowls he has are from, you know, the early 1900s. And you know, he said that what saddened him about the whole thing was when he retires, when he no longer wants to do this or is able to do this, this is gone. All the recipes that are in his head are gone. The method of doing things are gone. They only use, you know, 5 ingredients or whatever to make their chocolate, and it's all pure. They get their peanuts from the same place for their nut clusters, and they roast them on premises again in a machine that's, you know, double my age.
Got it.
And it just got me thinking about craft as sort of the inverse of progress in a way, where when these little businesses are gone, so goes the knowledge that allowed them to run for so many years,
you yeah. know,
and nobody's interested in taking it over. And there was
a story, there's lots of hipsters from Brooklyn who will go up there and run a candy store.
Maybe, but you know, I asked him about it. He said, nobody's interested. You know, and there's a guy who makes boots in Utah, I believe, makes them by hand and has, you know, for 40 years, and he's retiring soon. And he's in the same kind of situation where nobody wants to take over the work. Nobody wants to, you know, put that much time and effort and craft into making a product that's not seen as valuable.
Well, and that okay. was kind of the,
go ahead.
I think you're putting a lot of value judgments on both the choice of people to do or not to do these things and the objective worth of what all these people are doing. And I'm not saying it's not worthwhile, but like, if somebody looks in and is younger and is just like, well, I can't make a living doing that. Well, they're not going to get into that business from the beginning. You know what I mean? Like, and
he's making a living doing it.
Yeah. But it could be just because he had the business and the machines from 100 years ago that his daddy bought and, you know, that, or great grandfather bought, or, you know what I mean? That kind of thing where, you know, it's funny because now we have, at least in the world that I live in down here, it's all about all this artisanal, everyone opening up their own little thing, you know, young people opening up businesses, very similar to what you're talking about, where they're doing things by hand and using old machinery. And I mean, this is the kind of stuff that gets a lot of press, right? I do wonder about the absolute numbers of all this stuff. How many businesses are going out of business and this stuff is being lost versus how many people are going in and taking those over or starting their own sort of, for lack of a better word, artisanal businesses going forward, whether it's a net gain or a net loss, you know?
Absolutely. And that's absolutely a set of data that I don't know.
Yeah, you know? Right.
I mean, there
we have a lot of anecdotal stuff on both sides, but sure, I don't know where it all
there are places that are doing that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a company that does handmade jeans and denim in Duarte, back near where I used to live in California, called Railcar Fine Goods.
Right.
And by all account, they make fantastic products, and it's all made by hand on, you know, old machines. But these things, there seem to be enclaves of where they are prevalent rather than dotting the country like they once did.
Yeah, absolutely. But, and it's funny though, that places like this Nelson's place, I mean, these are in largely places that make their money from tourism and people coming through doing antiquing or seeing stuff in the fall. And, I mean, a lot of these towns, and you know, I grew up in Connecticut. My wife grew up in a ski town up in Vermont. I mean, it's very similar there, where, you know, there's the businesses that are for the locals and there's the businesses that are for the people coming through, you know, which I always find really interesting too. Yeah, it's, I don't, it's really, it is interesting. So where'd you come down on all this?
I don't know. I'm still thinking through it. I mean, I came down on it. One part was, you know, if it were within my purview to be able to do it,
I would buy jeans and candy.
I would buy a business like this just to keep it alive and to learn this. There's a nobility in learning this craft and something so simple, in the same way that I think there's a nobility in being a plumber or laying brick or, you know, providing that sort of,
you're like Will Hunting right now.
I'm like, who?
In Good Will Hunting. Oh, he says almost the same stuff, doesn't he?
Maybe. Yeah. But there is that, that blue collar, and it's this is my family.
The question is,
right?
Could you do the same thing for 40 years? Or would that drive you crazy?
Well, I mean, think about this. It's even longer. This is the other part of it. The candy, in the case of Doug Nelson, candy is his entire life.
Yeah.
His
probably
grandfather,
never touches the stuff.
His father, his, you know, him. He likes a good piece of fudge now and again.
That's it, though.
That's his favorite.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, I mean, knowing one thing and only one thing that has been the mainstay of your family for generations is fascinating to me.
Oh, I think it's fascinating. I think though that there is a lot of romance put into it that the day to day doesn't belie.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed.
I think people like you and I looking in from the outside going, oh my God, I'd love to live in a small town and make candy for a living, because it feels like a fairy tale.
It absolutely does. Yeah. So I asked him if he would be willing to sit down and have another conversation and roll tape. And he's like, absolutely. So we're going to try and figure out something for October to go up and have a longer conversation with Mr. Nelson and talk about some of this stuff. It is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And again, partially because my family history is so blue collar.
Yep.
You know, my railroad history goes back 5 generations, and this type of thing. And, you know, we've talked about the whole Studs Terkel working and,
sure,
and this part of America fascinates me.
But do,
this part of,
do you see, so you see defining progress in this way. You see progress as people aren't buying handmade candy anymore. They're buying Hershey's, and therefore these places are going out of business in the long term.
Sure. That's part of it. Yeah. Ingredients are being changed to cut corners.
Sure.
Processes are being altered to speed up the end result.
Well, it's like that, the Gladwell podcast where he talked about the old McDonald's French fries recently.
I haven't heard it, but they used to be cooked in beef tallow.
Right. And he actually has somebody make him some in beef tallow so he can go back and forth. And, you know, it's drastically.
It's a very different flavor. I remember those from being a kid.
And that's the funny thing is that there's a lot of people who, you know, you and I are old enough to remember the originals because I was 16 or 17 when they stopped making them. But there's a lot of people who were born after that who have never had real McDonald's French, like the McDonald's French fries that people talk about, you know?
Right.
And the reasons
where
why
they
those,
were that beautiful golden crispy brown and then kind of almost puffy on the inside.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. But of course, when they made that change, they were doing it for reasons of, and here, I'll put a link in the show notes to this episode. McDonald's broke my heart. It's from a few weeks ago. They did it because this one guy had a heart attack and he was rich and he decided to start, you know, railing against fat in
lobbying
food.
Against the fat. Yeah.
And basically scared them into changing it into, you know, these oils, which are actually in the long run, we learn worse for your body than eating. You know, so it's really funny how these things change. Yeah. It is interesting to me though, like businesses like this candy business or the dairy and stuff, a lot of like the way that they market themselves is this idea that we've been around forever, you know, which is always interesting. It's like, it's always a little bit of a nostalgia play, you know?
Sure. I mean, you go to Nelson's Candies, Wilton.com, and there's a big masthead, established 1914.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, on their website, the established 1914 is bigger than the Nelson's Candy chocolates, brittles and fudge.
So I know very well that I romanticize this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because part of me wants it to be that way again. Part of me wants us to value small businesses and in a way that I don't think we do by and large, or at least in a way that they're not valued by big business.
I think that that is true, but I also think it's a little bit like that that story that Ed Koch once told. I may have said this on the podcast before. I saw an interview with Ed Koch, who was a mayor of New York City in the 1980s, I think it was, and he won the mayorship, but he hadn't yet started. He was sort of like, you know, his ramp up, and he was walking with some people along the boardwalk down in Coney Island or somewhere down there. And this old woman said, Mr. Mayor. And he went over to talk to her and she grabbed his hand and she leans in and she said, please make it like it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'll try, ma'am, but I don't think it ever was the way you think it was. You know,
I don't know. I mean, if you look at the photos on the wall there,
Look at the photos on the wall of our childhoods. You know what I mean? That we look at in the way that we look at them.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, I mean, that's an interesting photographic angle of this, which is just the idea of photographs and the past being seen automatically through a nostalgic lens because of the fact that we're not there at that moment. You know, you know, my aunt passed away a few weeks ago in a car crash.
Mm-hmm.
And my cousin sent a picture of my father and me. Well, we're both in the picture, sort of on different sides of the picture. From, I don't know, 19, I think we decided it was 84 or something like that. I'm around that age. And it's interesting looking at me in that moment and thinking, oh wow, my childhood in this weird, almost dreamlike way of looking back at this photo of me from 30 something years ago. Right.
Right.
Now if I'm smiling and I'm being a goofy kid, right. But like my memories outside of that image are very different of that time. So, you know, which is correct, that, you know, this sort of thing that I've been, the way that I see it in my head when I think about it, or the way that this picture, which I hadn't seen in 30 years or didn't even know existed, you know, is portraying it, or somewhere in between. I think that it's, I think it's very rare, at least for me to look at a picture from the past and automatically go to the negative.
Hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I
think
I do.
We tend to give, I mean, we give pictures the benefit of the doubt.
I think we can. I mean, for a long time, I had very different memories of my own childhood than I do now.
Okay.
You know, because I had to, with my father, for example, I had to cast him in a certain role,
sure,
to make my beliefs about him hold up.
Yep.
And then I look at photographs that were uncovered that I've seen before, obviously.
Right.
But I look at them differently and I go, well, wait a minute. This was at a time when I knew that I felt this way.
Right.
But I'm not seeing me feeling that way in this photograph.
Yeah. Yep.
So which is the truth?
Right. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. 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 And of course, you know, as you get older, I think we tend to, I think it's a little bit like feeling pain. You know, when you look at a picture of yourself, if you remember back for when you broke your arm, you don't remember the pain that you felt when you broke your arm. You know?
Right. Right.
I think our brains are good at that, at looking at things and seeing the, you know, I was watching the other day, Conrad was late from work per usual lately. She hasn't had a day off since July 28th.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. 31 days. But she was late and I was sitting here doing some work and I flipped up in the laptop and I started watching Watchmen cause it was on HBO.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this, you know, there's
not
this,
a great movie.
Yeah. I think it's visually very beautiful. And I think there are moments in it that are amazing. I think the opening credits are amazing. But yeah, I mean, it has its flaws. I generally like it more than a lot of other people do. And I'm not even a big fan of the comic, or at least I wasn't. Anyway, the reason I bring it up is that there's a character in it that essentially gets raped, but then she's talking about it. She's like, you know, the past looks real different at the, you know, on the other side of 60 or whatever it is, you know, the less days you have in front of you, the better the days behind you look. So yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as somebody who had family businesses in their families, you know, growing up and stuff. Yeah, I don't know what I would do if I had like taken over the record stores and lived that life. That's a very different world,
right,
than I live now, certainly. Yeah, I don't know.
I'm still working through it all, but
no,
it was,
it's fascinating.
There was a profound effect that seeing these places and experiencing,
sure,
a little bit of them had on me to the point where I want to go back with recording gear,
yeah,
and explore more, not just with Mr. Nelson, but
yeah,
you know, maybe this becomes a new series. I don't know,
yeah,
but there's something in here that I, you know, I'm like a dog with a bone on this thing. Now it won't get out of my head. There's, yeah, something there that has to be explored.
I will say that I am a little bit biased in the sense that I grew up, or, you know, went to school and grew up more in that area, certainly than you did. You know, that's, mm-hmm, you're in my world when you're, mm-hmm, up there, essentially. So it's the part that you're getting sucked into. I mean, there were places in my hometown that were a lot like that. To me, I see them as like, yes, this is the story they want you to, not that place specifically, but this is what these places in New England, this is what the area wants you to believe about itself, you know?
Well, then well done.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. It worked.
I also want to go back. We went to a little place on the wharf, called Becky's Diner.
Okay.
Which is a diner that's been there for years, but it's the go-to spot for the fishermen before they go out for the day's work and when they come back. And so I want to go back again with some recording gear and be there at midnight, 1 a.m, when these guys and girls come in and get some of these stories, because this is another life that's completely foreign to me. But I am, at least from a distance, because I don't know much about it, I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
And I would like to tell some of these stories before they're, or share some of these stories before they're gone for good.
Yeah. I remember when Conrad and I were driving to Pittsburgh a couple few years ago, and we were taking the back roads through Pennsylvania. We stopped for eggs in this small town you can only get to via state road, you know, in the middle of mm-hmm. nowhere. Like, there was no reason to go through there unless you were going through there, you know? And it was something like, you know, $2.20 for eggs and toast and potatoes.
Right.
I mean, it was just like, it was just silly, you know, to the point of being like, where is this place? Where are we right now? You know?
Right.
And it's all locals, you know, sitting there doing their thing. Yeah. It's fascinating. Well, I'm glad you had a good time up there. It's definitely a place with a, very specific draw,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I always find really fascinating.
I enjoyed it a great deal.
Serious drug problems going on up there right now. Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine.
I have heard about that. Yeah.
Real bad heroin stuff. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Bad heroin, bad fentanyl, all, you know, the whole sort of oxy thing.
Well, the other thing about all these places is that it didn't used to be made up of places selling candy to tourists. These were like mill towns and that kind of stuff.
Right.
All the mills left, you know? So it's
mills and manufacturing. Sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, these towns where they used to hustle and bustle at a different rate. So one thing that Portland still has, at least some of the fishing that it used to have,
mm-hmm.
some of these more inland towns, it's like whatever was there is just gone.
Right. You know? The mills are now co-opted into condos or something, if they're even still there.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. That's exactly what happened. So yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Fun.
What else you got in here? You got some, I watched some of these, videos, and then, is Photographic Goals related to the color and style or those?
A little bit of camera news real quick.
Okay.
Those of you who are Micro Four Thirds shooters, apparently new Olympus EM 10 Mark III will be announced, end of the month. They're saying by August 31st or on August 31st. Looks like it's going to be a pretty cool little camera. Still a 16 megapixel sensor, but apparently no anti-aliasing filter, and still the 5-axis sensor shift and 4K. So
is the EM10 the equivalent of like the T10? I guess
X-T10,
it is
X-T10. Yeah, X-T10, X-T20.
So it's,
I think,
similar.
So it's probably
sort of
it's the little brother to their flagship EM1.
Right.
Yeah. Tilty flippy screen, touch screen, apparently.
Yeah.
You know, there's a spec page on Four Thirds Rumors.
And Canon put out a new lens this morning that was really weird, a 85-14 IS.
Huh.
Which is supposedly a replacement for the 85-12.
Hmm.
Right. Which I find kind of interesting.
Is the 85-12, I thought that was like one of their flagship lenses.
It is. And I think the new one is an L lens too. So I got an email about it from like B&H or something this morning, and I would just kind of flip by it. Interesting.
What are they going to charge for this thing?
Probably way too much. I mean, these lenses are not cheap.
Here we go. 85 F1.4, 1600.
Yeah, that's actually a lot cheaper than the 1.2.
Wow. Oh, they've got a new tilt shift lens out too. Huh.
See, all kinds of, what's the tilt shift?
Let's see. Tilt shift of image from the Canon TSE 50mm 2.8 macro.
Weird.
A 90mm 2.8 macro and a 135 f4. All tilt shift.
Interesting.
Yeah, you wouldn't think there would be that big of a demand for
tilt shift lenses.
Yeah, I mean, to warrant the design effect, and development of three new pieces of glass.
And $2,200 lenses. Yeah, would you say 50, 90, and 135?
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, look at these new guys. Weird. I'll put a link just to the 50 just in here just so other people can go see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tilt shift is one of those things that, like, yeah, how often do you actually, your average person need it, you know, except for special effects.
Right.
It's a very useful thing, though, if there's certain things you need tilt shift for, either architectural stuff or macro stuff or, you know, trying to, there's a lot of famous portraits that are done on bigger cameras because they could do all kinds of crazy tilt shifting and pull the subject and the background into a plane of focus by kind of skimming across them and stuff. So, you know, the nose is in focus. Somebody's turned slightly away. The nose is in focus and the ear are technically in the same plane, but the ear is out of focus because mm-hmm. they tilted the plane of focus.
Thrown the plane. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of, it's weird. It's funky hey, thing.
Have you used this Luminar, the MacFun Luminar? Have you tried that yet?
You know, it's funny. I did last week install Luminar and play with it.
How
just
do you
a little
like
bit.
It? Because the new episode of MacBreak Weekly, Leo and Scott Bourne were talking about it a little bit. And yeah. Bourne, while he swearing is on the board it. Of directors,
yep.
But swears by it, says it's a terrific piece of software despite being on the board, says he's been using it for years.
It was very slow with the raw files from my camera.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where I was like loading one in and I was waiting. And then I played with it a little bit and I was like waiting. And I was like, I don't have time to deal with this right now.
So any actually adjustment you made, you felt like you were waiting.
Yes, but it could be user error. I didn't dig deep enough. I got onto other things. So yeah, I had installed it. I haven't played with it yet. Deep enough.
I think I might grab the trial. Anybody out there using Luminar Neptune from MacFun? Shoot us an email, podcast@ontakingpictures.com.
I think it's one of from what I've seen and the way their marketing materials are presented, it seems like it's less of a, you're dialing in exactly what you want in the way you want it. And you're giving the software a little more of the heavy lifting as far as knowing what to do where. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like you're dialing in, like, I want this to have more, it's more like you working as an art director than you working as a Photoshop technician, if that makes
interesting.
Sense.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't know much about it. I mean, I kind of have my tools.
And I could be entirely wrong about that, but just from the reading that I spent 20 minutes reading about it and as I was downloading it and stuff. So I don't know if it's the right tool for me, but then again, I do a lot of hand stuff on my pictures afterwards. So I don't know. It's a raw development is step one of my process. So it's not the end all be all where some people doing raw processing is the only stuff they do, you know?
Right. Right.
So yeah,
we had somebody in the group, as a matter of fact, on that subject ask, you know, about Photoshop and said he wasn't getting what he wanted out of Lightroom. And I wonder, you know, and I asked in
what
the comments,
what it is that he's trying to get.
Yeah. What do you feel like you're missing from Lightroom? Because I tend to kind of go the other way. I think that the editors have gotten so good that unless you really have some sort of specific use case, you can get pretty close to what you need just in, you know, Lightroom or Capture One or whatever.
Yeah. I think it depends on the kind of stuff you're doing. I mean, if you need to get in there and, you know, do some retouching on faces and shifting this around and that kind of stuff. I mean, you're not doing the sort of like liquify stuff, that kind of thing in Lightroom. And your masking tools aren't as powerful. So going in and working on specific parts of the image and that kind of stuff, you certainly have a lot more control in say something like Photoshop than you do in a raw converter, but for people who are coming from either they're photographers from the film world, or just the kind of people who are not sitting there with a Wacom trying to figure out exactly. Basically, I want more saturation. Maybe I want more saturation in the sky and I want to do this and I want to bring the blues up. Yeah, you could do all that in Lightroom or Capture One or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you want to go in and go, God, I can't stand the way that one broken piece of that fence is. I want to go fix that. Well, you're not doing that in Lightroom.
Right.
So different tools for different things. That it depends, I think, how you look at the kind of work you're trying to do and what you're trying to accomplish. Last night. So for some reason, in Capture One doesn't have lens profiles for the Pentax lenses, which I completely understand because it doesn't think that they should be in there. Now, luckily the 35 millimeter lens that in my setup that needs the most sort of curvature help and stuff, just cause it's a wide angled lens on a medium format, it needs a little work. The profile, the recipe for that lens is very similar to the phase one lens of the same.
Phase makes a 35.
Phase makes a 35, and you add, and if you put that lens correction on, it's almost identical to the Pentax lens correction. So that's fine. But my 45 to 85 zoom that I use doesn't. So what I had been doing was bringing my pictures into Photoshop and using a lens correction in there, and it'll correct it, you know, not to the raw data, but there's more than enough pixels to do it right in Photoshop. But for some reason, when I go into lens correction lately in CC 2014, it's grayed out. The drop downs for all of the lens profiles. It's almost like the lens profile somehow got deleted from my computer. What I need to do is uninstall Photoshop and reinstall and see if that works. But last night, in the process of doing that, I installed Photoshop CC 2017, which, man, I keep going back to 14 because 2017 is like so much slower to me. I get weird spinnies all the time. And
oh, really?
Yeah. It's just, I find it awful. And I know this is, I've tweeted about it before because I keep going back, but I keep thinking, oh, maybe I just need to go get the new version. I got the new version last night. I was like, ugh, it's like almost unusable. And like how big the palettes are and everything. I'm just like, ugh, I keep going back to the old one. Yeah, it's weird, right?
Yeah.
But remember back in the day when they would come out with a new version of Photoshop or a new version of whatever, and if you went back two versions, it would be so much faster because it was so much lighter and smaller and, you know,
right.
It's a little bit like that, I think, where right. I'm using the version from 3 years ago, which yes, is losing some of the really high end masking features and stuff that I do sometimes need, but ooh, it's just annoying. Anyway, I don't know where I'm going with that.
I've been using the Affinity products and I have been very happy with them.
Yeah. I like that Affinity photo.
Yeah.
It seems to work really well.
Yeah.
If I was starting from nothing right now, I would consider it. But there is also the problem of sometimes I have to send TIFFs to people with adjustment layers and stuff in them, and they got to open them, you know?
Right. Yeah. If you're working with other people, that's a different use case, I think.
Yeah. And that's, it's upsetting that that's the way it is, but it's, you know, you kind of got to stick. It's like if you're editing video, it's like, well, you're using Avid or Premiere or whatever it is, you know, because that's what the people you're working with use. It's a tough thing. Anyway, sorry. Color and style. You were saying something else.
Color and style. And check. I just pasted something in. We just got an email from a listener about this. It's kind of cool.
Okay.
A little audible.
Oh yeah. Look at that. Didn't photographer, we talk about this?
I don't remember if we did or not.
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
Anyway. Sean Tucker, who I talked to for an episode of PD, has a terrific YouTube channel, and his latest video, he's talking about color. And editing color, and how the colors that you use in your photograph or accentuate or downplay communicate as much or maybe even more than your composition or subject matter. And it was kind of a neat I love the way Sean talks about photography. And so he offered up a few different examples of how color affects mood and how we receive either meaning or the emotion of a particular picture. And he used film as an example, and he used three films. He used The Martian, The Revenant, and what was the third one? Mad Max Fury Road. And he pulled color palettes from each of them. And if you've ever seen The Martian, you'll see it's a lot of reds and oranges and browns and very little blue. In fact, the blue is almost completely missing from the color palette. And that gives you a certain feeling when you watch the film. It gives you a certain emotional connection to the film. Then The Revenant, by contrast, is almost the complete opposite of The Martian, in that the reds and yellows and oranges are almost completely absent in favor of the blues, the purples, and this very subdued, cooled color palette, which accentuates this sort of feeling of isolation and what the character, Leo's character in this case, is going through in this sort of vastness of the wilderness. And then, you know, Fury Road, it was kind of over the top. Fury Road is very saturate, very, very, big and bold. And in fact, if you have seen Mad Max Fury Road, which I can't recommend enough, terrific film, there's also a black and white version of it called, I think it's called the Black Chrome version.
Yeah, it's on the DVD or on the Blu-ray.
Yeah. I think it's on the DVD. If not, you can find it online. George Miller.
Is it silent as well?
Yes. All that's in it, there's the orchestral score and the sound effects, but no dialogue. And it is a very different viewing experience without the color present. And so it just got me, you know, thinking about color and wanted to kind of pass that on to listeners in terms of when you're processing your photographs, think about the colors that you're using and the colors that are absent from the picture as additional vehicles for communicating what it is that you're trying to communicate in your photographs.
Yeah. It's like a third or fourth vector, you know?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So there are a couple links in the show notes for some applications that you can use to extract color palettes from photographs. And what Sean suggests is, you know, even if you're looking at other people's work, start looking at what types of colors they're using and how those colors in turn make you feel when you're looking at the work.
Right.
And I think it's something that we can be a little more intentional about our color. We can be a little more intentional about when and how we use certain colors to communicate mood. And he goes through a couple examples of taking four photographs straight out of camera that look very different and bringing them more in line with one another so they look like they're part of a similar portfolio. And this was the other thing that he was talking about is oftentimes when you look at a photographer's work, there's a cohesiveness that is tied to the colors that they tend to use or the color toning or grading that they tend to gravitate towards. Yep. That becomes a signature style as much as the subject matter itself.
Yeah, I agree. There's also, I use an app called, well, it used to be Adobe Color, which was an app on iOS that basically lets you take pictures with your camera or go into your camera roll and it'll pull X number of colors out of it. Mm-hmm. And you can actually tell it, oh, I want this to be, you know, show me a setup that's actually, you know, warmer or cooler, or more contrasty or whatever. And then you can save those as color palettes. They now apparently do this inside of an app called Adobe Capture CC, which I haven't, I was just upgrading to as you were telling the story about
Adobe
the other apps.
Capture CC. Is this a Mac app or
it's a phone app
as well?
It's a phone app. And I used to use a version, this Adobe Color thing, which apparently now has been deprecated and it's all inside of Adobe Capture, which I can't vouch for, but I do like Adobe Color. But it's the same kind of thing. You take a picture and it'll go pull, you know, the palette out of the photograph or whatever. Mm-hmm, it's useful if you're walking past something or you see a painting. I do that a lot. I'll find a painting at a museum and I'll be like, oh, I really like the way that feels. And I'll take a picture and then I'll run this thing. And then it'll be like, oh, that's nice. I see where he was going with this.
And it's interesting because if you shift one way or another, you do have a different reaction. There's a different sort of visceral reaction to the image.
Yep. It's interesting. I've been thinking about this stuff a lot lately and I've actually been playing with my colors more than I used to lately. I'm a little more subtle about it. It's funny when I'm working on a picture and I'll be doing this kind of stuff where I'll be tinting stuff and whatever. If I turn off the layers that are doing the tinting, I generally go, oh, actually I like it better with a little more saturation rather than desaturated or what I basically, there's a lot of times that I actually prefer the original to the graded one, as it were.
Like straight out of camera original?
No, I mean, not that original, but I mean, you know, straight out of Lightroom or Capture One, you know, I'll bring it into Photoshop. I'll do work on it. I'll add some color tinting to it and stuff. But if in the process, sometimes I'll turn those off while I'm working on something else and I'll go, yeah, the color tinting is too heavy handed. Like it almost, if it feels fake when I'm turning it on and off, I tend to push against it mentally. And I don't know why. I think it's just something I'm a phase I'm going through, I guess. But it is interesting that, I mean, yes, there are a lot of things that you don't notice how tinted they are until you really look at them deeper, you know, and you go, holy crap.
Right.
There's, you know, that does not look like real life. So lately I've been finding myself somewhere in between the two. So I'll take the tinting stuff and kind of pull the opacity back a little bit and go somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it is really interesting. It also depends on especially when it's where they're portraits, it's like a whole other thing because, you know, you have to be careful because you can really mess with skin tones. And it's interesting that I think you can seemingly mess with skin tones more in moving image than you can in stills without it looking weird. You know what I mean? Like if people are moving in a movie, you don't notice them being really green, you know, like The Matrix or whatever. But if you just took
that sort of teal orange thing that we've talked about.
Yeah, right. But if you do that,
it was so popular for so long.
If you do it that saturated in a still, I find it distracting to the point where I'm like, oh, that feels like a bad color tint, you know, to it. Mm-hmm. I want to correct it whenever I see that.
I wonder what it is about motion that allows you to forgive that a little bit more.
I mean, like if you watch Amelie, you know, which is an absolutely beautiful film, which if anybody who's listening to the show hasn't watched Amelie, go watch Amelie.
Yeah.
Cause it's the colors are beautiful and the shots are beautiful. In fact, I haven't watched Amelie in a while. I should watch Amelie. It is heavily saturated in a lot of shots where you look at it and you go, oh my God, if you hit the reds
and the greens are almost outside the spectrum.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't bother you when you're watching it, but if you like just stop it and look at stills of it, you're like, ooh, I guess it's less that I think that it's wrong and more that I look at it and think, oh my God, if I was doing that, I would never have pushed it that far. Perhaps to my detriment, you know, but I certainly look at it and go, wow, I wouldn't have made that choice. As much as I love the choice that somebody else made, it's almost like I don't have the guts to push it that far, you know, which is
interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. You understand what I'm trying to get at or?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I do.
I'll put a link to, there's got to be some nice Amelie color grading stuff in here.
Here.
Video?
Yeah. Go look at that.
Go look at that.
Go look at that. Oh, right.
I remember this. Yeah. Yeah. God, what a good movie.
There was also one guy like completely. Oh, here. He deconstructed it and it shows like what we were just talking about, like what it would look like corrected, like versus how it appeared in the film.
Yeah, there we go. That's good.
Yeah, look at some of those stills. We'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, I mean, I always think about Amelie as one of the more extreme examples of that. I feel like that's the beginning of extreme color grading in modern movies. I always think of Amelie as sort of
Amelie is one. That's Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is another one that's terrific exactly. example.
See, there's so in this link, the Evan Richards one, so there's all the like the little screenshots right in the first little thing where he just takes them and does the corrected, not corrected, not corrected.
Yeah.
Okay. The shot second from the bottom of the guy in the moped driving by the statue.
Yes.
See, that one seems so completely out to me that it's distracting. I know it's not in while you're watching the movie, but it feels really wrong to me. Well, and
the one above it. Look how much shadow detail is lost.
Exactly. There's another example. Right. Where if I had done that at home and I put that much of an effect on it, I'd be like, that's not right. You know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, and it's also interesting. I mean, and I don't disagree with Sean, I think that this video is really great, but I also think that I think in the old days, people used to choose a film or a way that they shot, you know, I use this film with this filter in front of it to shoot these portraits. And that's how they all have the same feel to them. I think nowadays with, you know, these modern sensors that don't generally have as much of a character of their own, you have to choose the character. And I think that in the past, I don't know, 5 years or so, I think we've gone along this route where the zeitgeist is now to have this really very distinct color palette to your images, which I think was generally was somewhat true in the past, but is even arguably overly true now. I think, mm-hmm. I think this is a phase we're going through a little bit. Not to say it's wrong or that it won't be around a while, but I could see that ebbing and going the other direction at some point. You know, people saying, we have all these possibilities. Why would you stop yourself from
right.
exploring, you know, just for consistency's sake or whatever it is?
Do you feel like the sensors have evened out at all? Because I know, you know, several years ago, you know, Canon had their sort of
their look.
Yeah. And that was one of the reasons it became a favorite of wedding photographers, because Canon renders skin beautifully, or at least it did. Whereas Nikon, they almost went the Kodachrome route where they had really punchy, saturate colors.
Yeah.
And it was just a little different. You know, you would see a difference in the way each camera produced an image side by side. Has that evened out a little bit, or do you think it's gone the other way with like built-in film simulations that all these cameras have now?
I think that the stock images of, if you took a picture with a, you know, by the way, that new Nikon's beautiful.
The 850?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah. I mean, if you were going to stick with 35, that's the camera to go for, in my opinion. But I never, in my 10 years of shooting Canon, I never thought, oh God, I love the skin tones out of my Canon. I get way better skin tones out of the Sony sensor in my new camera than I ever did out of my Canon. Now, I'm also working from the raw files and going from there. It could be that the internal JPEGs, which maybe a lot of the wedding shooters and that stuff were shooting, you know, just for time's sake, was more pleasant out of the box. I think the Nikon, when Nikon switched to Sony sensors and or whatever 5 years ago, I think that they really kind of got a lot better. Mm-hmm. I remember people switching from Nikon to Canon for the reasons that you say, friends of mine did. But then, you know, then I was for a while, right before I got the Pentax, I shot with Dan's 810 D810 Nikon
for
a few shoots. And I was like, oh my God, these have so much more room in these raw files. Like I want that, you know? So I guess it depends what you're going for, but I think overall there isn't nearly as much of a character to a sensor nowadays as there was back in the day to a specific film, you know? Either in Capture One now, I have these weird, God, what is that? Here, I'll pull it up. I was just playing with Capture One styles, you know, like their film simulation things that people make for it.
Right.
And there's this one company that makes a bunch or a handful that you can download for free as just sort of here, you know, to have a taste and maybe you'll come back and buy the full set. And one of the ones that they sell is, hold on a second, I'm just trying to open this thing up. Of course it's spinning wheel, whatever, is a Kodachrome Ektachrome Blue. So it's basically like a mid 70s Ektachrome that may be the expired or something like that. So it's got this really blue tinge to it. And it's funny. And I look at it and I go, yeah, man, like films had a really different feel to them. A lot of them, you know, like I know what certain portrait films feel like. We all know what Kodachrome looks like. We all know, you know, in a way that certainly I can't look at a picture and automatically know that it came from an Olympus or a Canon or whatever. I know there are people who say that they can, but I think if you did a double blind study, they'd be much less able to than you think they would. You know, I think a little bit of that is perception. But then of course you have the cameras like all these Fujis, right? Which have these amazing color film simulations
built in. Yeah, yeah, sure.
I didn't realize you can do on the Fujis and might be, can yours do it? Film simulation bracketing. So you can take the same shot in multiple film simulations each time?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a cool effect.
You can also do it after the fact. You can go and reprocess the RAW and spit out a different simulation.
Camera.
Yeah, in camera.
Okay, yeah. Because that's a neat idea. Like, oh, I'm going to go out and shoot this stuff. Give me the Velvia and the black and white Arcos or whatever it is.
Just so I can see right up front what they're going to look like.
Yeah. It's kind of a neat idea, especially if you're shooting JPEGs, which if I shot Fuji most of the time I would, because I think the JPEGs are lovely.
Hey, it looks like Nikon released a film scanner alongside the 850.
Oh, you know what I think they put out a thing ES2 that clicks on the
film
front of
digitizing adapter.
Yeah. It plugs onto the front of your camera and then you put film in it. Basically, remember how I've shot I've used a macro lens to shoot film.
Yeah, that's the way they're doing it. It's just it's a factory way of doing that.
Exactly. Yeah. It's actually a really good idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. If they did it for quarter, 2.25, I would, and I shot an Icon, I would definitely get one. That's super cool. Yeah. Have you ever been in one of those Lomography stores?
Yes.
What do you think of the Lomo thing? Do you think that it's...
It's interesting. I mean, I had a friend of mine named Jeff Holmes bought one of the LCAs, 15, 20 years ago. And it was a neat little camera. I think their films, by and large, for me anyway, are a little over the top in the way that they appear. And it's almost a, this is what you get, just sort of deal with it. You know, there's not a lot of latitude after the fact.
Yeah.
It's if that's what you're going for, then I think it's a terrific source.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Man,
yeah.
You're right. This 850 does look pretty sweet.
I mean, if I'm telling you, like, that's nuts.
Yikes.
It's real tough looking at a camera like that and going, yeah, nice small. Well, relatively small for the money. Nice.
Yeah. I have been in one. It just doesn't seem to be necessarily for me.
Yep. I get it. Shooting negatives. You know, the hard thing about shooting negatives, especially color ones, is that colored negatives have a yellow tinge to them.
Yep.
You know, because the stock itself is kind of yellowish.
It's got that ambery stock.
Right. Yep. So it's trying to get rid of, like, inverting that cast is the hard part. And I remember years ago, I was scanning some negatives for a show that I was doing, and I rented time on an Imicon, like one of those tower kind of Imicon ones where you put it in and it actually curves the film a little bit as it goes past the scanning element so that the part that is going past the thing is actually curved a little bit to keep it from getting, I don't know, like the Newton's rings or whatever. I don't know exactly how it was doing, but it was like a way to flatten the film right where it was getting scanned, was to like kind of curve it a little bit. But one of the reasons why the scanner was so amazing was that they had made custom inversions, basically custom profiles for every film stock. So if you were shooting Portra 400 VC or whatever, they had taken pictures with Portra 400 VC and figured out what the cast was by putting in pictures of a color chart or whatever. So that when it inverted it, it negated it perfectly. And it was sort of like, oh man, this is what I wish I had at home. I mean, I can take my flatbed out and I could put film on it and scan it. But if I go in and just do like a eyedropper to try to like invert it or whatever, it's like, it's never quite right. And then you got to fidget with it to get the color the way you think it should be. But this was the minute you clicked the film type, it was like boop, and it was like, oh wow, look at that! You know, the amount of
it's magic.
Oh my god, it's amazing! And I never quite understood why none of the scanner manufacturers built these things into their scanning software. I mean, this would be like the thing that I'd want, you know. And maybe they did, and I'm just too stupid to know. So if anybody out there is like, Bill, you're too stupid to know, just let me know.
Podcast on taking pictures. But subject line, Bill, you're too stupid to know, empty message.
I will say that those Imicon scanners, which, you know, at the time cost, well, they're $17,000 on, still on, at, B&H Photo, $17,000. Here's one selling one, a serviced one with new belt and lamps for $4,000 on, God, that's so expensive. Film big scanners. Money, they don't make any of those things anymore. Remember like Minolta and all those used to make the little film scanners 15 years ago where
I think Nikon still makes a film scanner.
Oh, do they? Okay.
I think so.
And a lot of them though were 35 only, right? They didn't go to medium format. Mm-hmm. Man, film scanning. God, that's they're the Nikon Super Cool Scan 5000 ED. Guess how much it costs?
Oh gosh, I don't know. $2,500?
$3,700.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot.
God, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Scanning, man. It's expensive. We went off on a tangent there.
What a shock.
Wait, did we even get to photographic goals, or should we put that to next week since we're like an hour and 10 minutes in already?
Yeah, we probably can. Photographic goals. We'll talk about that next week.
Is that all right?
Yeah, it's good.
I want to know give me a taste of where you're going so I can think about it and have stuff to say.
Well, I think a lot of people proceed on their photographic journey without really having a goal in mind.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I were to ask you, yeah, Bill, what's your photographic goal?
Yeah, well, that's like, what's your life goal?
But if you don't have a photographic goal, then how do you know whether you're getting further or closer to it?
Yep.
You know, I mean, I know you've said in the past that your goal is to, or one of the things that you would like to do with your photography, I'm not going to use a goal,
sure,
is to create an iconic portrait of subject X,
sure,
whatever that subject is.
Yep.
But on the one hand, that's such a loosey-goosey goal. How do you know, A, whether you've achieved it, and B, if you're on the right path to achieve it?
I think this is a good topic, but I think, yeah, okay. Well, let's save it for next
week. So just as an example.
Yep. I think that the entire thing of goals is so incredibly hard to define, because you can't, as you say, be so loosey-goosey that it lacks meaning. But then you can also get so specific to where it lacks meaning, right? It's like, mm-hmm, you know, I want to, I don't know, be taking pictures for this magazine. It's like, well, what if that magazine goes out of business before you get there? Was that really your goal, or was your goal to, you know?
Well, but then you could say, you know, I'm a landscape photographer, let's say, and I want to make pictures that can stand alongside Weston and Adams, not looking like their style, but look appropriate in a lineup with those other photographers.
Okay.
Well, that's something that you can work towards.
That's
a definable and actionable, I think, end result.
But interestingly enough, it is defined by your relation to someone else's work in that case.
Yeah, in that case, yeah, sure,
yeah,
sure, sure,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So, okay, yeah, lots of things to talk about, but we'll put a pin in that and we'll discuss it next week, because that's...
Yep, sounds good.
We'll go deeper. We'll go real deep.
Sounds good.
But at the moment, we're going to talk about our sponsor of the day, FreshBooks.
FreshBooks?
Yeah, they're fresh.
Jiggity FreshBooks?
Where did the Jiggity FreshBooks come from?
I don't know. My friend Keith is like, everything's Jiggity Fresh.
Oh, really? Oh, that's
nice. Yeah, I don't know.
Let me take a little sip of my drink here. To all freelancers out there right now, you know that the worst part about doing your job is invoicing people and getting paid. FreshBooks, our friends
at FreshBooks. That's the freelance life, right? Up, down.
It really is, and it's a giant, giant nightmare. And our friends at FreshBooks have made it a ridiculously easy cloud accounting software for freelancers, and they're making this just for you. You can send quick, professional, clean-looking invoices in about 30 seconds. With literally two clicks, you can set yourself up to receive payments online. You can take pictures of your receipts using the mobile app, FreshBooks mobile app, and claim your expenses. Makes it a million times easier. They rebuilt the whole thing from the ground up in the last few years, and it's custom-built for the way that you work. So get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid quickly. And getting paid quickly is the really important part about this stuff. And you can tell because they've got these notifications when people read your invoice. And so no one can say, oh, I didn't get your invoice. Well, yeah, you did. You read it on October 23rd or whatever it is. And it'll even send reminders to these people. So if they haven't paid you in time, it'll say, remember, you have 1 week to pay Jeffrey, or else he's going to send out his goons to come take the money from you.
Wait, I have goons?
Wouldn't that be fun to have goons?
Hey, you guys, go collect.
And if you're working with other people, you got these projects features that let you share files and messages with your clients and employees, and let you see how quickly things happen when your conversations are all in one place, which is really, really nice. Multi-currency invoicing. So if you're working with people from Canada or Switzerlandia, you can get paid in francs and Canadians beans. Use Canadian dollars, right? Is
that what francs and beans.
Francs and beans. it's just like, it puts a pin in the whole idea of the guessing game. So, you know, when people see invoices, you know, when you get paid, you can tell when due dates are coming up. And if you have any problems whatsoever, FreshBooks has award-winning customer service. It's amazingly helpful, super friendly, has zero attitude. Plus a real life person will usually answer in three rings or less. So they're going to do a lot of the work for you. And if you have any problems, they're going to help you fix it. If you're listening to this and you're not using FreshBooks yet, now would be the time to try it. FreshBooks is offering an unrestricted 30-day free trial for all of our listeners. No credit card required. All you have to do is go to FreshBooks.com, enter "on taking pictures" in the "How did you hear from us" section, and give them a shot. I know that the whole idea of accounting software and everything, just put it on the cloud, man. Then you don't have to worry about having the thing installed.
Put it on the cloud, man.
Yeah,
that should be their T-shirt.
Put it on the cloud, man. Put your invoices on the cloud.
Right.
It'll rain money.
Maybe they'll do that with version 4.2.
4.0. So thank you very much to FreshBooks for supporting On Taking Pictures in 5x5. All right, where do you want to go?
Hey, I'm sending you two things. Look at this. I'm putting two things in the Skype. Yeah. So, excuse me. This is just an aside that means nothing other than it kind of amused me. So I'm working on the iBooks version of the book, right?
Okay.
And I exported an EPUB and then imported that into iBooks Author.
Holy camole.
And I got
That's
David
what you
Carson.
Got?
It looks like a David say, Carson poster.
Especially the first one with the T and the
yeah, stuff. With the viewfinder.
So how did this...
No idea what happened.
Wait,
but
you imported a PDF?
No, an EPUB.
Oh, an EPUB. Okay.
And it just it bunged everything together and rendered the type all funky.
Just overlaid all the type over the top of each other.
That first one, I love that, and I want to do a big print of it.
Okay, you know how who's the guy Geary, the
Frank
architect?
Geary. Yeah, Frank Geary.
Famously uses aircraft design software in order to design his buildings.
His buildings. Yep.
Because they give these smooth sweeps and it's all based upon algorithms and angles and, you know. I wonder if, Jeffrey, you could create a new career as an avant-garde designer by just designing things right and importing them into iBooks.
It's kind of weird, right?
Yeah.
This picture, I'll put it up somewhere. In fact, I'm going to do a post on my site, on Jeffrey Sidoris, about what happened, and I'll post some screenshots. But... I couldn't produce this intentionally on my best day, and I absolutely love the way it turned out.
Well, yeah, there's certainly nothing like what you normally do.
No. So I'll try and get something up today or tomorrow and include some of these screenshots on my site, and then I'll post a link in the group.
Oh, that's so funny.
Kind of funny though, right?
Yeah.
Like just completely obliterated the original look of it, but I kind of like where it went. Anyway.
That is really funny. Yeah. Hey, so I watched the whole Oliphant backdrop
you did.
Video.
Good.
Yep.
Good. What did you think? Other than you thought that Peter Hurley seemed bored at times.
Oh, I think he felt less bored when I watched the whole thing. But I thought that it was very interesting. I thought one of the things that I thought was really interesting is the way she talked to the person about what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Although I would imagine that a lot of the people who come to her want stuff that's like the stuff she's done before. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we'll look at a picture of Annie's or
Seliger backdrop.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that that's got to be, and I'm just spitballing here, but my guess is that 75% of her people who come to her want that. You know, it's people at my level or something that want to buy a $2,000 drop that, you know, looks like that or whatever. Which is perfectly valid, but it's interesting how she's talking about it as if every single one of them is completely different. When I bet you there's a few handful of things that she does a lot of, you know,
certainly variations on a theme. Yeah. 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 But you know what she does that I really love is she, I mean, we've all seen those, like the bad high school, you know, just modeled backdrops.
Sure. Yeah.
What she's doing on some level is making those types of backgrounds, but doing them with such craft and finesse that they become art in and of themselves.
Yeah,
but it is that same process of sort of scumbling and layering and, you know, dabbing on and dabbing off. But she does it with such care and craft that it sort of transcends the style that it that has become kind of the punching bag.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep. It is interesting too that she was saying at some point in there that her that anything before number 500 or something was probably done by the mid 80s. So you can actually look at her work and see it as a progression over time of the kinds of things that she makes.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of the early ones, which ironically are very 1980s terrible looking.
Mm-hmm.
There's some in there that are just like, ooh, you kept that one,
rough.
You know? Yeah. Which, you know, could be used to special effect by somebody. I understand why she keeps them, but it's certainly not like she's always made these subtle things that she makes now the whole time, you know, which I found fascinating. I also find it fascinating that it turns out that she got her start with Cherevkov, who was one of our photographers of the week.
Right.
A while back, who my agent used to studio manage his studio back in the day. So I've met the guy. And so it's interesting that he needed, you know, sky backdrops for these crazy pictures he was doing. And so she went and painted skies for his backgrounds. And then he started doing that kind of stuff. And then people, you know, expanded out of there. People started wanting like sort of modeled backdrops. So she started figuring out how to do that. And I think a lot of it ends up being just, you know, messing with it. You know, it was interesting that she didn't talk about technique at all. And I don't blame her necessarily. The only time you actually see her doing anything is when it seems like she had a drop on the ground. She had a lot of paint on it and then a lot of water. And she was just moving it around with a roller.
Kind of rolling it out, moving it around. Yeah.
I was trying to figure out what that would do in the long run. You know what I mean? Like how much pigment was down there versus how much water. Mm-hmm.
Is it just water or is there some sort of additive to the water?
Right. Like mediums to slow it down and that kind of stuff. Right. I mean, that's a lot of what this stuff is.
Here, this kind of goes full circle about what we were talking about at the beginning.
Yep.
You know, she is not only at the top of her game.
Yep.
She kind of is the game.
Yeah, there's a handful of people who do this at this level.
Yeah.
She's
been doing this, they say, 79, 78, like that?
The interesting thing, though, is that, I mean, you could go back, you know, in our Wayback Machine, you and I, jump back to 1980 when you were 40.
When we started the show?
Yeah, and I was 6. And you know, there may have been people at the time, Jeffrey, who were saying, oh, all these people have been painting backdrops since the 30s. No one cares about the work that they do, you know, and somebody picked up the mantle. She did.
Right.
Whether the market required it and she was the person to pick it up or what have you, you know, or, I mean, she even says in it, she says, you know, basically a lot of this stuff is just luck, right place, right time. I was doing this stuff and this one guy gave me a call because I knew this other guy. You know what I mean? Like that's the way a lot of this stuff works.
And if you started this business right now, would somebody be interviewing you 38 years from now?
Right. I also find it interesting whenever I hear somebody talking about this kind of stuff and telling their story, it is almost invariably, I was doing this and then this happened to me and pulled me in this direction and that's where I am today. It's very rarely I sat down to accomplish X and I worked towards X and now I have X.
Right. I knew in high school that I wanted to paint backdrops.
Right.
And went towards that.
It's never that. It's, oh, I was in school for painting and I was doing this. And then this guy called me and that got me doing that. And then this other thing happened. And so I guess towards our conversation of next week of what your artistic goal is, you know, like even if you make one, how do you know when to let it go because a better offer comes along, you know? And if in the end, it really is all about where the winds of history, for lack of a better word, take you, then why try to find a thing in the first place? Like why try to find a goal in the first place if it's really not about reaching that goal. It's about being on the road so that you can meet people on the road that take you on tangents, you know? It's interesting. I think that it was also interesting the way that she was talking about the backdrops. And she even said, you know, sometimes photographers come and talk to me in this certain way photographically. And I don't understand what they're saying, 'cause I don't know anything about that. What I know about are give me values, give me color ideas, just general mood of what you're looking to get. And then even Peter Hurley even says, or the two of them go back and forth about the big one that he had made years ago by her, where he says, yeah, it shoots blue. Like I was looking for something warm, but this ended up shooting cool, even though, you know, we were shooting for warm. We were aiming to get it warm, but when you take pictures on it, it feels cool. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she was sort of not throwing her hands up, but just sort of like, hey, sometimes it happens, you know, and we do it. You would think that she would have all this stuff way down more to a formula of knowing exactly how to get what effect.
Yeah, but then again, maybe there's a way that the sensor records it that is different than how it looks to your eye.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
on an extreme example, when we went to see Rush, the colors of the light were one color, and I'm shooting pictures, and the pictures that are on the back of on the screen are completely different in value, especially the blues
are completely
different than what I'm seeing.
Well, that's more of the auto white balance of the camera, right? Or of the phone.
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I think, no, certainly. And the way light bounces off of things. I mean, I know this from my own experience of painting drops for myself, is that what it looks like in, you know, under a softbox in camera is generally way different than it looks on the floor while you're painting it, or when it's wet versus when it's dry, or so it's interesting trying to make decisions. I mean, you know this way better than I do, so maybe speak to this a little bit, but knowing what paint looks like wet versus what it's going to look like later.
Sure.
Is an experience thing?
I think, you know, not knowing how she preps her canvases. I mean, how much of it soaks in versus how much sits on the surface.
She does gesso them, which I'm surprised by, because when you look at a lot of the pictures taken with her backdrops, they feel very texturized, you know, like they have a very canvasy texture to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I like find
the one of what's his name? Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah, right.
That one looks very sort of just stiffy, canvasy.
You know? Right. And a lot of these, you know, so when you use gessoed canvas, or you gesso your own canvas, a lot of that gets smoothed out. You know what I mean? Like that texture. And I always wondered, like, wait, I always figured she was working on raw. She just stapled down raw canvas and would use the raw canvas to keep that texture and to essentially stain the fibers versus paint on top of the fibers. But it seems
she is using rollers too. So you're going to get a little nap from the roller.
Yeah. It's like all of it is really interesting. I mean, I would find it fascinating to basically just be a fly on the wall for a day or two there.
Yeah. Just watch her, not even ask questions, just watch it happen. Absolutely.
And not even from I'm going to go start a business to compete with you, but just, you know, cause I'm not going to spend thousands of dollars on a backdrop from her. At least I can't right now. But I would love to think, oh, that's how she's generally getting that effect. And let me go play with ways to do that, you know, which I kind of find interesting.
There's still a part of me that doesn't want to know.
Well, sure.
You know, and I was having a conversation with Ben Thomas this morning. He's getting ready to leave on this amazing tour of he's going to California, and then he's got a show in, I think, Montreal, and then he's coming to New York, and we're trying to figure out dates where he can come to DC.
Right.
And we were talking about some of his new work, and he's like, oh yeah, I'll take you through it when I see you. And I was like, I don't want to know. I don't want to know how you do it, because I look at it and I have to go, God, I wonder how he does that.
Right.
And there's a big part of me that doesn't want to see behind the curtain, because that's what makes this body of work unique to him that nobody else is doing. And if I know how the trick is done, you know, or if I know that in this case,
takes the magic away for you.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, Ben, for what it's worth, if you're in New York and want to hang out with me, I'll find out how it's done. That's interesting.
See how you are.
I'm just interested.
Like taking the guy's juice.
Oh, I wouldn't. I don't make stuff like that. So it's interesting to me how he does it. You know,
it is interesting that his shooting, like the ideal conditions for his pictures, are what most photographers absolutely try to avoid. And
bright,
that is
clear, yeah, middle
bright,
of the day.
Clear middle of the day. Hard right. shadows.
Right.
You
right.
know, most photographers would look at that and go, ooh.
Right. He needs, like, he needs yep. it to look angular.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He needs it to feel like a Hockney painting.
Yeah, in a sense. Yeah.
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 It's so yeah, I don't know. It's I thought that watching the video, if anybody hasn't watched it, you should go watch it because it is interesting. Where she's just talking about to Peter Hurley about the process of making these things and how she got into it and the differences between different ones and the whole thing is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But
I enjoyed it.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, you know, it's interesting about one of the ones she rolled out, she said that the person wanted it distressed and she did mention that they would go on it with sandpaper.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen, there was a backdrop that she used once or that Annie used once of hers. I do believe it was of, Danny Boyle and the actor from Slumdog.
Okay.
Whatever the kid's name is.
The little kid. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the medium kid, the adult version of the male.
Okay. Okay.
That guy. I always forget his name. It looked like if you had taken a rug and put it at the front entrance of a building and 1,000 people had walked over it for a year. You know what I mean? Mm. Like it had that kind of worn look to where I actually have a backdrop that I keep threatening to basically just tape down on the sidewalk in front of the house. You know, just to see if people walking across it and getting it dirty and whatever it is.
Would they take it? Would people take it?
No. Nah. Around me? Right. Nah. I live in a weird place. But yeah, I almost want people walking across it. You know, I want people wearing it down. I want it to get threadbare a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And she also said that things get almost waxy after a while, like we're just kind of, you know, smoothed down, which is why they use the sandpaper, which I thought was actually kind of interesting. So yeah.
Just go drag it behind a taxi or something.
Yeah, exactly. You want that, but not, you don't want it too roughed up. You just want it sort of like worn, you know?
Right.
So yeah, anyway, interesting. Well, we're about an hour and a half in, so let's go to the group and we'll
go to the group.
We'll come back next week. Going to the group.
To the group. Elusive. Oh man. Dennis. Lennarts.
Oh, look at that. It's beautiful.
That's amazing. That it looks like a Rothko painting that somebody swam into, that some creature swam into. That's fantastic.
Yeah, nice job.
Yeah, well done.
Jake Ballston, I like that one too.
That's
just the grays.
That's nice. Yep, that's nice.
The bald eagle. Classic bald eagle.
Classic.
A lot of those out west, huh?
I've seen more since I've been here than I ever saw out west.
What do you think about the eclipse photos as a general rule?
They're okay. I think the people with the longer lenses or the agencies that have access to larger telescopes tend to get bigger ones. Although I will say that Michael Hendrickson got some fantastic ones.
Yeah.
And this Bobby Ellis picture is terrific.
Yep. Yeah. Mario Mirabile's picture of the guy on the couch with the concrete wall.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of cool backdrops.
That's a great looking wall. Yeah.
I still think that the wall in the King's Speech in Jeffrey Rush's office behind the couch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is one of the cooler things ever made. And there's disagreeing stories of whether or not it was there from like that was in that space. And they just used
or
it
they
created it.
It.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The art director lady said it was there and then somebody else said they made it. So it's sort of like, could be
telling tales out of school.
Exactly. Mark Farrington. I like that. I like the little crazy, stuff on the backdrop and then the biker in front.
Yep. Florian. Love that shot of, two folks in a boat on the lake.
It's entitled Two Folks in a Boat on a Lake.
On a lake. That's what I would call it. I'm not creative in that way.
Joshua Peterson's. Look at that picture. Of the eclipse.
Oh yeah, the cycles of the eclipse. Yeah, that's very cool.
That's beautiful. He was real close to totality there.
Yeah, we didn't get much at all. I think 70% or something.
You didn't watch it?
I watched it on NASA TV.
Okay.
The girl and I watched it on online.
I was out there. It was actually pretty cool on the street, I have to say, watching people from all, you know, disparate forms of life. I was outside of Conrad's building, actually. And it was, you know, lawyers who make $1 million a year and the security people and the, you know, the cleaning people all standing outside looking up at this guy going, wow, and like passing around glasses to each other so they could all look up and that kind of stuff. Right. And ours only got to whatever, 73% or whatever. But it was still pretty cool. Got my glasses at the Smithsonian.
Did you?
Yeah, when we were down there a few weeks ago with the kids at the HAZI, they had a table set up, you know, trying to tell people what to do and whatever it is. And so they, in fact, I have the glasses right in front of me. And I want to wear them like, you know, like the guy in Greece who wears the 3D glasses?
Right.
I want to wear them. The problem is you can't see a damn thing with these things on. Because they're almost essentially, it's like entirely, they're like ND filters that are 15 stops, you know?
Right, right.
So you can't see anything through.
I think you should still wear them. Don't, you know, don't give up on your dream, man.
Whoa! that would be sad. You got an idea for this week?
This week, yep. Inspired by the trip, local business.
Local business.
Put up pictures of your some of your favorite local businesses.
It's a good idea.
Doesn't have to be a mom and pop place, but you know what are the places that are part of your routine? What are the restaurants you go to? What are the gas stations you go to? What are the farmers markets you go to? A little slice of listener life. What are some of your favorite local businesses?
Little slice of heaven.
Right.
The I can't believe we haven't used this photographer of the week before.
But I can't either. I thought that we did.
But it's not on the list, right?
It's not on the list.
Okay. Yeah. This week's photographer of the week, William Wegman, who you may know from his pictures of dogs. But he's been around for a long time and his work is wonderful. I watched the Art of Photography video that you put up.
With Ted. Yep.
Yeah, which was really interesting, him talking about Ted. His own work.
I think Ted listens.
Oh, he does? Okay. Hi, Ted.
I think so. If he does. Ted, hi.
If he does, yes.
Yeah. Ted, if you're listening, let's talk.
It's interesting that he was saying that one of the things, so he used to be a video artist and a painter.
Yep.
And then sort of fell into photography as like an avant-garde thing in the late 60s, which led him to early videotape projects, art as videos, a lot of them using his dogs. Did you... The one thing of his teaching his dog how to spell that whole thing is like, right. We said beach, you wrote B-E-E-B-E-E-C-H. And he's like looking at the dog and the dog's like, you know, he's like, no, that's incorrect. We're talking about the sand. So it's B-E-A-C-H. The dog is just like, wait, what? Uh-huh. And then I guess he got invited to use the Polaroid 20x24. It's interesting that he said, no, I'm not interested. I like making smaller format things. And the person kept calling. Man, he's lucky that person kept calling because
right.
This is where he's made his bones. So he started making these photographs on the big Polaroid 20x24 camera, which if you haven't seen pictures of or don't know anything about, I'll put a link in the show notes for that as well. And started using his dog, Man Ray, as a stand-in for subjects in these pictures. And a lot of them are classics of the era, you know?
Yeah.
I always think of him as sort of the non-sexual dog version of Mapplethorpe. Does that make any sense at all?
A little bit, but it's kind of frightening.
Were you a Wegman?
I love Whisper of in the floral shirt with the big Elvis collar.
Yeah.
So good.
Were you a Wegman fan over the years?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I have no problem with his work. I think it's interesting. I think it's quirky and fun. Yeah. And I think I kind of discovered Wegman at a time when I was taking photography very seriously.
Sure.
And this was kind of a breath of fresh air, you know, that you could have fun with photography and be kind of quirky and irreverent. And it didn't have to be serious portraiture or serious still lifes or serious landscapes, that it could be fun and still be steeped in craft.
Yeah. Although ironically, his photographs are technically very well done.
Yeah.
I mean, like his stuff is steeped in craft. Even if the stuff that comes off of it is has silliness to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Also, used by Elsa Dorfman, who is the subject of that documentary, which I keep meaning to watch. I think it'll be out on video, the B-side, Errol Morris movie.
But
the dog thing is really interesting. Again, another example of, oh, and I had my dogs around, so I just started shooting my dogs and it took off, you know?
It's no different than Theron Humphrey shooting Maddie having Maddie on things become this, you know, this phenomenon.
Yeah. Or Obey becoming a thing with Andre the Giant.
Sure.
Yeah. You know? So in trying to find new ways to.
No.
What?
Well, he made that. I mean, it wasn't.
Yeah. But the fact that it took off was not necessarily a guarantee. You see what I'm saying?
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Like he just chose a thing and hey, it grabbed on to something. It is interesting though, because he was saying that he likes the fact that the 20x24 is the size that it is. And it's not like a digital file where you can print it at any size. What'd you think of that comment? Did you catch that in the video? He was basically, go ahead.
No, go ahead. What were you saying?
Well, I just think that is a very, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that comment, but I get what he means in the sense
it is what it is, but. Yeah. Your 50 megapixel files that come out of your Pentax, you could make the same argument there that they are what they are.
Right. Yeah. So I could argue that I print them at 300 DPI at whatever they are, and I'll get a 28x20 inch image and it'll look great. And
right.
I
never and that's, print them that's what you get.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Same with you. I get what he means. I don't know that should mean that those photographs wouldn't look good at different sizes because I think they would.
And I'd be willing to bet that there are scans and smaller prints of all of those images.
Sure. I mean, he's got a brand new book coming out. I just put a link in there from Chronicle that,
right.
I mean, the book is not 28x24 or whatever it is. And they're fantastic.
Right.
So
maybe the book should be 28x24.
Like one of those big Taschen, the big Taschen, Leibovitz book comes with its own tripod.
Yeah.
$7,800.
Who are these rich people who buy stuff like that? Like, really, who are they? Like, what?
I don't know. $7,000 on a book is a big chunk of change.
And then a big giant chunk of your room just to have a book on a stand? It's weird. It's really, really weird. I'm impressed that the dogs are that cool about doing this.
Yeah.
You know, like, how do you get a dog to stand up on a bicycle? Like, in that picture. Like, what? All right, well, stay there.
He's got to have a great rapport with them. I mean, they obviously know that he is their people kind of thing,
Yep. Anyway, William Wegman, I'm surprised we never talked about him before. I think he is a slightly polarizing figure. I think both you and I generally like his work, but I think there are people who generally dislike his work. So,
well, yes, because I think for some, he tends to fall into that sort of Ann Getty's kitschy, cute category.
Yes, but I think that this is way better than Ann Getty's, in my opinion.
Sure. You know, I mean, you know, however you feel about it. But I think that's one of the things where it's like, oh, cute pictures of dogs. How quaint.
Yeah.
You know, it's not taken seriously as a technical photographer.
Sure. Although two thirds of the way down, there's that Léger picture, the dog in profile with the different colors in the spaces that are empty, which I think is just lovely. Red in the upper left-hand corner, black on the right.
Red in the upper left and then the gold. Yeah.
Yep. It's beautiful. If you want to get a hold of us, 347-687-9411. We'll send us a voicemail. Podcast at ontakingpictures.com. At Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris on Instagram and Twitter. And if you want to buy Jeffrey's book, is it The Art of Photography? Photographybybytheletter.com,
nope,
right?
Just photographybybytheletter.com. You can also get there through my site.
I put a link in the show notes already. Thank you. Earlier. I got to go buy my copy. I completely forgot. I missed the launch.
It was a soft launch. I just wanted to make sure everything worked and wasn't broken. So I didn't really say anything about it much.
Okay. So go buy your copy. subsidize Jeffrey's trips to Maine so he can go record.
So I can go get more chocolate and yeah.
And
subsidize Jeffrey's trips to Maine. Hey Bill, can we do the show on Thursday? I'm going to Maine.
I've been going to Maine. Maine's very beautiful. I want you to go back there in February or March and tell me if you still think it's beautiful.
Right.
When it's 6 below and
well,
the day gets dark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah. Several people said you got to come back in October when the leaves are changing. That's when it's at its most beautiful.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well,
would
you, know,
would you say that that's true? Is that in your experience up there?
It's funny because, I mean, where I grew up, the leaves change in the same way just a little later. So it's like mid-November. And to me, leaves changing and falling and me having to rake all those leaves is like a memory of having to do yard work. Where for people who don't live in that area, it's, you know what I mean? It's like anything, right? Like, you know, what you don't appreciate what is in front of you.
Do you now miss that?
I don't miss it, but if I go up for a couple of days, I appreciate it for a couple of days. But I think if I lived there again, I would not appreciate it again, you know? I think it's one of those things that you look at from the outside and you go, wow, that's absolutely beautiful. And I just never noticed before. In the same way that the fog over San Francisco is beautiful, but the people who live there are just like, goddamn fog, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
you know, or
yeah, what was it? The quote, the, is it a frost with the coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that one of the verses to, I left my heart in San Francisco.
Right. It got cut. That's the on the 12 inch.
Route. Yeah, that's the fourth verse, the infamous fourth verse. So go listen to the show and go make some images, and we will see y'all here next week.
Yeah, we'll see you next week for talking about goals.
I know this is going to be a big one.
It's going to be big. I think it'll be fun.
All right, I'm going to try to define some stuff so we can talk about it.
Yeah. All right. Have a great week, everyone. Thank you for listening.
All right. See ya.
Right?
Yep.
We should thank them, right?
Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. People. That's the nicest thing that anyone's ever done for me.
Wait, what was that?
You don't know that? You know that?
No.
That's from the Christmas Carol musical from the 80s, I think. 70s.
I missed that one.
Thank you very much. That's the nicest thing that anyone's ever done. Anyway, see y'all later.
All right, see ya.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way. Try to